GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit jltus.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Welcome. I'm a scientist, author, and environmental entrepreneur who founded GreenSense. That's why I get to serve as host.
I'm Bob Kessler, serving as executive producer. And on this week's show, Mike Keene, who knows a lot about sustainable cities, he's here to tell us about some of the great new ideas that cities are doing to combat climate change. In Orange County, California, Robert, they're passing out bottles of wastewater for people to drink. That's how pure they can make it, so that could be revolutionary. And Tom Appel of Consumer Guide Automotive has the test drive of a new Hyundai all-electric vehicle.
Tom Appel is up first with Green Automotive News. He's the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, and he joins us now. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
And I understand that you've driven the Hyundai. I never can pronounce it. How do you say that?
They say that it rhymes with Sunday, so it should be Hyundai. I tend to say Hyundai, but it's Hyundai.
Hyundai. The Hyundai, Ioniq all-electric car. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the big news this year for a lot of people was going to be the Chevrolet Bolt and the Tesla Model 3. And I'm excited to say that there's a little piece of news that kind of sprung up from the green car world that I wasn't really expecting. And that's the Hyundai Ioniq Electric. We all knew this car was coming, but because it had a lower range than some of the cars that were coming on the horizon, you know, it was just sort of an also-ran vehicle in a lot of people's mind. I'd like to correct that. It's actually a fantastic little car, and I'm really glad I had the chance to drive it.
What did you like about it, Tom?
It fits in a great place. Right now, we're looking at cars that get 80 to 90 miles of range, or cars that get 200 plus miles of range. The Ioniq, with its 28 kilowatt hour battery, fits in between those cars. It has a claimed 124 miles of range in consumer guide testing. That was really closer to 135 or 40, but it's also priceless than these other cars. But even more than that, it's just a fun car to drive. It's a sedan with a hatchback. It's very roomy for its size. It's fun to drive. And one of the nice things is it's not especially extrovertedly style. It doesn't scream electric when you drive the vehicle. There isn't all sort of stuff reminding you of range or electric performance. It's much more like just driving a regular car. And I really appreciate that.
Tom, why would car companies stratify the range that cars get?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there's something that very interesting that happens here. The Chevy Bolt, for example, which has a fantastic 238 miles of claimed range, uses a 60 kilowatt hour battery that's relatively heavy. This actually hurts its efficiency because it's always carrying around that battery. So its MPGE rating, that's its miles per gallon equivalent from the EPA, is about 119. The Ioniq, which uses a smaller battery, is actually more efficient energy-wise and has a 136 MPGE rating. And that's important if you're trying to actually use less energy. Now, if you're just trying to use less gas or if you need the range, obviously the Bolt makes more sense. But the other thing that the Ioniq is less expensive than the Bolt, and this is because you're not paying for as much battery. It's about $7,000 less expensive, and I think that matters a lot to a lot of consumers.
Well, when you first came on and we reviewed the Volt, the whole philosophy behind the Volt was that people only traveled 25 or 30 miles a day, so that's why they had that range so low. What's changed, and why do people need these further ranges, or was their logic flawed?
I think the original logic behind the Volt with a V actually made some sense. And there's a lot of people who could get by with that. And they didn't have to worry because they could switch over to gasoline if they needed to. Now we have the Ioniq with this interesting 124-mile range. You can go a couple of days without having to charge if you wanted to. You can go a little bit further. And I think that it makes the most sense for two-car families, where you have one car to go great distances if you have to, and another one that's a perfect daily commuter that you don't have to worry about having to charge every single day.
And speaking of charge, how long does it take to go from empty to a full charge?
This is a 27 kilowatt hour battery, so you're probably looking at a full charge in about 4 or 5 hours.
And what about charge anxiety? When we first started testing electric cars, and I remember I drove one, you're always worried about running out of charge, and you can't have a truck come and give you a charge like a car that runs out of gas. how do you deal with charge anxiety these days?
Yeah, and it hasn't improved that much. The good news is that level 3 charging, and that's super fast charging, is finally becoming a little bit more available. What you're seeing now is the development of stations that will charge on the both of the two standards that are currently out there. One is called CHAdeMO, and the other is called as SAE Combo. And they're different systems, and this made the setting up of these charge stations somewhat complicated. Someone decided that we should have both, and we should see more of these soon because it looks like the economics is starting to make sense. Those are great if you need a quick charge on the road in a hurry. They don't usually make financial sense, but it also keeps you out of an emergency.
Tom, sum this up. Why is this car so much fun to drive?
This car is fun to drive because it doesn't seem like an electric car. It's light, it's nimble, it's relatively quick, it has a nice clean interior, and it doesn't remind you all the time that it's an electric car. It's one of the closest to a conventional vehicle, electric vehicles that I've driven, and I'm a big fan of the Ioniq.
That's why you're the guru of gears. Thanks, Tom, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
All of Tom's articles and reviews, including this one, can be found at consumerguide.com. We've linked it on this week's show notes. Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. Takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you.
It's a hot one. Sweat's dripping out of every pore. You reach for a tall, cool glass of highly purified wastewater to quench your thirst. Doesn't sound too appealing, but if that water were purified using the latest technology, will the stigma be removed and will consumers accept it as a clean source of drinking water? That's just what they're doing in Orange County, California, and we're joined by Mehul Patel, Director of Water Production for the Orange County Water District. Mehul, thanks for calling all the way from California.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's start out simple. Where does wastewater come from and what's in it?
Yeah, so wastewater comes from both houses and businesses, industrial facilities. So anything that ends up in your drain, basically sinks, washing machines, showers, at least in California, not the irrigation, anything that you use outside, but everything inside the home usually ends up at a central wastewater treatment facility.
And there's some nasty stuff from businesses that go in there, aren't there?
There can be, but especially here in Orange County in California, the businesses can only discharge certain qualities that are stated in the permit that they hold. So even industrial facilities have to have a permit to put things in the sewer. And so the agency that runs the sewer system, Orange County Sanitation District, tries to limit the certain constituents from even getting to the sewer, because not only would it be difficult for us, you know, that are going to purify the water, but it's difficult for their normal wastewater treatment process that they put the water through in order to dispose of the treated wastewater into the Pacific Ocean.
So explain your special process of making potable water from wastewater.
Yeah, so the water that we get has already been through several steps of treatment at the Orange County Sanitation District. So it's what we call secondary effluent or treated wastewater. What we do is we put it through three advanced treatment steps. One's called microfiltration, another one's called reverse osmosis, and another one's called UV light with hydrogen peroxide or advanced oxidation. By using these three advanced treatment processes, we can take the already highly treated wastewater and purify it, basically take it to beyond drinking water standard. And that way, once we get it to that standard, we can use that water to help replenish the local groundwater aquifer, which is the main drinking water supply for about 2.4 million people in our service area.
Well, I'm a recovering hydrogeologist, so I understand the science behind wastewater treatment and can feel comfortable with drinking highly purified wastewater. But how do you get consumers over the stigma of drinking wastewater? I know you've recently started a campaign in California to pass out bottles of the highly purified water. What was the people's reaction, and could you get them over the stigma?
Yeah, I think in our kickoff event, the reception was overwhelmingly positive. There's always going to be a little bit of apprehension, and that's part of why we're doing this outreach campaign using water that's bottled from our facility. Is first we have to educate people on why the water's safe, why we're even doing it, and why we need to go to finding alternative sources of water to alleviate our lack of water or drought issues that we have in Southern California. And once people find out what the water's been through and how that water compares with other water sources, most people are able to come around and get over the psychological factor of where the water came from. We kind of say that we don't want the water to be biased on where it came from, but where it is today.
That's a good one. The saying goes, necessity is the mother of invention. California is in need of more potable water, and it's been that way for a long time. What brought about this innovation to be able to highly purify wastewater?
So a couple of things. The first thing is that the technology itself has gotten so much better and become more affordable. The technology we're using has been around for almost 40 or 50 years, but it hasn't been used extensively in municipal water treatment, mostly in industrial processes where you need highly efficient treatment processes to produce like food products and things like of that nature. So that in combination with the fact that we've been able to test all of the technologies here on a pilot scale before implementing it has kind of made it to where the technology not only is viable, but it's cost effective. And that's a big selling point for us even trying to get to this level of treatment and pursuing this option.
If you've just joined us, I'm Robert Colangelo. You're listening to Green Sense. My guest is Mehul Patel, Director of Water Protection for the Orange County Water District. And we're talking about their project to ultra purify wastewater into potable drinking water. Well, you talked a little bit about the economics. Tell us how the costs compare with other methods of getting potable water for California consumers.
Yeah, so for our particular case here in Southern California and in Orange County, we have to compare the other sources being, we do have some natural sources, local river water that we use to replenish our aquifer. But mainly what we're trying to compare ourselves against is the other major source of water is imported water. So there's water that's brought in through the Colorado River system or from Northern California. And typically that water is available through a local retailer and it averages somewhere around $1,000 an acre foot. And we use acre foot a lot here in Southern California from the old farming days. And our water that we're producing today, we can produce for about $500 an acre foot. Now, our water does, you know, have some subsidy to it because we've got some grants from the federal and state government for the construction. But even if the subsidy amounts were taken out, we're still producing the water about $700 an acre foot with all those subsidies taken out. So our goal all along was we had to have water that was produced at a cost that was equivalent or hopefully slightly less than imported water, which would be our other alternative source beyond the local sources that are available for replenishing the aquifer.
Now, is your goal to sell bottled water, or is it to be able to convey that to the consumer through a pipeline?
No, our ultimate goal for bottling the water from our plant is strictly for educational purposes. And even the ability to bottle the water for educational purposes required an act of our state legislature in California. And part of the legislative act is that the water cannot be sold, nor would we want to, but it only can be used for educational purposes and in limited quantities. So our goal is not really to sell or make money on the water. Our goal is to get outreach about not only conservation, water availability, but this alternative source of water and why it's necessary and how it will be used in other parts of Southern California as well, is to get that message out. Because ultimately, the water that we produce from our facility never goes directly to anyone's tap. It goes into the aquifer where it mixes with other native groundwater, and then that groundwater is pumped out by all the local retailers and used as drinking water for consumers.
That's Mehul Patel, Director of Water Production for the Orange County Water District, telling us about the recycled wastewater that they're making pure enough to drink in Orange County. This is Robert Colangelo on Green Sense with a reminder to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. While the U.S. announced it's pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, we continue to see a strong effort on the local level to combat climate change. Dr. Mike Keene has been a professor of sociology and sustainability studies at Indiana University South Bend. He also formed the Center for Sustainable Future and now runs Thrive Michiana, a consultancy which is committed to fostering sustainability and innovation in Michigan, Indiana, and beyond. Mike, welcome back to Green Sense.
Glad to be here, Robert.
Well, when we last spoke, you were an academic that thought like an entrepreneur, and now you're an entrepreneur that thinks like an academic. How has the transition been from academia to entrepreneur?
Well, the transition has been faster than I thought it might be. And it's both been fun, but I've also had a few pitfalls. So I thought I'd take 18 months to kind of, make the transition and see what I wanted to do next. But I got involved in some projects, and all of a sudden, I had about a six-week transition. I've been doing some sustainable development work, trying to help build net zero homes. But the other thing that happened is I turned in all my financials and my tax account and said, oh boy, Mike, you got a lot to learn. And so I'm now trying to catch up with some things I didn't know.
Well, welcome to the speed of business. What do you like most about your new vocation?
Well, first of all, it's new. I was in the academic world for 30 years. I loved it, and I really just enjoyed working with the students. But I've always felt that sustainability has to work in the real world. And so in the university, we prefer students to go out and do that, but we kind of then leave them up to figure it on their own. I had some projects I really wanted to get going, and basically I'm really interested in trying to help us reduce the energy usage through our built environment, and really a focus on how can we create sustainable regional and local food systems. And this gives me a chance to actually work with the people who are on the ground making it happen, and that's been very exciting.
Well, you recently took part in the 2017 Michigan Clean Energy Conference and Fair. Summarize the highlights of the fair. Who attended? How many attended? What were the key points that were discussed?
Well, we were up in Traverse City, and there was about 100 folks there. Most of them were from Michigan, really talking about what's happening in terms of clean, renewable energy in Michigan. There was a number of speakers. The Great Lakes Renewable Energy Association represent, for example. They did bring in a former governor, Jennifer Granholm. That was really exciting to hear her talk a little bit about her perspective. They were talking a bit about what's going to be future of transportation, and it really looks like the electric autonomous vehicle is coming probably faster than we think. It's going to have a major disruption on the way we think about and live our lives in ways that we just can't imagine.
Mike, what were some of the cool ways that they talked about how the autonomous electric car will disrupt society?
Well, first of all, it's kind of like what the cell phone did, right? 15, 20 years ago, we couldn't have imagined the changes that have happened, and they're beginning to think about some things like that. So, for example, garages will become obsolete. And I've already got one developer I'm working with who, where we used to build our parking garages on a slant because it was cheaper, and you wouldn't put the ramp up there because you were losing space. He's now building his parking garages flat, plate, because he thinks in 20 years from now, he's going to need to turn that into something else. So just things as simple as that. We probably won't own cars. We'll own subscriptions. Think about how that's going to change our lives. It's going to make our transportation much more accessible for a wider number of people, because right now the average person costs $6,000 to $7,000 a year to own a car. Lots of people can't afford that. But if you're paying for a subscription or you're doing on a buy-ride situation, you don't have to own that whole car in order to get your first ride.
And maybe one of the things I like least, shoveling snow, we won't have to do because I won't need a driveway.
You won't need a driveway. Well, think about all the houses that have these driveways. And, you know, people are beginning to think about how are we going to turn our garages into an additional rec room, an additional bedroom. You know, what are we going to do to repurpose all of these things? And why are we building two-car garages anymore, you know, if we're living in the city?
Well, that's fascinating. I want to get to another point. While some of us are concerned that the President Trump announced the U.S. will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords, others see a groundswell of support by businesses, local government, and individuals for sustainable programs. What did you witness at this conference? Did you see what we've been observing?
That's exactly what I experienced. And I didn't go there. I went up to the conference again. You know, I'm trying to make the transition. So I'm saying, okay, how do these fairs work? Is this worth my value for money? What am I doing up here? And first of all, I found out these fairs are a great way to network. And I really got a lot of stuff out there. But the unexpected thing for me was to see the energy in the room and how many people had come together and how many people they were networking beyond to really make this really transition to a renewable energy future possible. And there's so many elements to it. I mean, one element, of course, is renewable energy. But the other element is the huge number of jobs that are going to come along with this. We're going to get a whole lot more jobs through renewable energy than we ever did through the fossil fuels. And these are actually healthy jobs. Somebody doesn't have to go down in a mine and risk their life. And, you know, what they're producing their power with is not polluting the atmosphere and destroying our lungs. And so that was really, really exciting. And the folks on the ground there, they were just saying, hey, you know, we're not too worried about what's happening at the federal level. They could really help us move a lot faster and be terrific if they were there. But we've got 324 mayors that have already signed on to continue to honor the Paris agreements. The Fortune 500 and Fortune 100 companies are already there. These folks are just, moving forward. And the amount of energy and the amount of momentum just seemed to me to be terrific. So I actually walked away from that conference really pumped. And this was just 100 people of a small regional conference.
Yeah, and if you extrapolate out that that's happening around the country, we really do have a groundswell of support. Mike, who do you see leading the charge? Is it local government? Is it businesses? Is it individuals?
I think that it's sort of a combination, as one always says, and that's perhaps a kind of weak answer. But let me put it this way. I think that perhaps the biggest charge has been led for a while by business, particularly those businesses that are somewhat larger or are looking to the future. And they can just see the future and they can see what's happening. And they know that they've got to plan for this transition. They're not looking about what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years. They're thinking about 20 or 25. And when you start thinking out in those terms, you basically see the writing on the wall. The other place that has been really exciting is the municipal level. I mean, right here in South Bend, our mayor and our city have been really moving forward in these ways. But boy, places like Grand Rapids and what I was hearing about what they're doing in Traverse City, there's several cities in Michigan that have made the commitment to go 100% sustainable in the next 5, 10, 15 years. And they see a way to get there. And then, of course, there are individuals. But I think that we've moved beyond the stage where it's just reliant on individuals. Any major social change, I'll put on my academic sociology hat, occurs when individuals, you know, get out there and start to create new ideas. And very often they're looked at a little weird and they're looked at beyond the pale. But at some point in time, you begin to get a critical mass of people catching up to them. And then that's when it takes off. That's what some people would refer to as the tipping point. And I believe with business and the municipalities, we've hit that tipping point. And so us individuals who have been out there in the front, you know, sort of pushing and breaking trail, they've caught up with us. And it's kind of cool. As a matter of fact, in some cases, they're moving beyond us.
So you think the efforts of businesses, individuals, and municipal leaders can be enough to compensate for the U.S. not being part of the Paris Accord?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think we could be a leader. And to sort of paraphrase Jennifer Granholm, she wasn't too worried about the fact that probably the United States is going to continue to keep up its end just because of what our businesses, our municipalities, and other people are doing. But the thing is we're missing out on the opportunity. What's happening is places like China and India and Germany already are going to step forward, and they are going to sort of take positions in this emerging new economy, and we'll be playing catch up. And that's the real sad part is that we've got the motion going, but we're not going to hold it back as much as we're going to lose out.
Well, let's go back to something you said about autonomous cars. With us reducing our individual parking for a city, that's going to be a big issue because cities have invested a lot in parking lots and parking spaces. What are current local officials doing when it comes to having some foresight on how to change cities for the future?
I don't know a lot of cities that are really thinking about that. I mean, I think some cities are sort of removing their parking requirements. A lot of cities don't have a lot of parking requirements, but some cities do. And so I know here in South Bend, we're not looking at removing parking requirements, but we are relooking at our whole zoning codes. The zoning code's been built largely for suburbia. And so we're needing to rethink that. But quite frankly, I think this is one of those things that is coming so fast that, number one, I don't think that everybody is clear that this is going to happen. I think there's still some doubt. And I think that it's just not on people's radar. I think, that autonomous car revolution, if it happens as fast as a cell phone revolution did, in 15 to 20 years, we're going to be living in a very different world when it comes to transportation, parking, and other sorts of things. And that, to many of us, that seems like that's a long time. But in the built environment, that's a very, very short time. And so I think, cities need to start thinking about this and taking advantage of, or at least planning for what's going to occur.
Mike, I really appreciate you being on the show, and I wish you the best in your transition from academia to entrepreneurialism. And come visit us when you've got some new endeavors going on out there that are newsworthy.
I certainly will, and I've appreciated, quite frankly, the mentorship of people like you and some other folks that I've been able to learn from. The best way to move into a new way is to find some people who know what they're doing, and learn as much as you can from them. And I'm just following that same old path.
Well, we're going to have to end the love fest, but right back at you. Take care and have a great week.
All right. You too, Robert. Bye-bye.
That's Mike Keen with Thrive Michiana joining us on GreenSense. This is Robert Colangelo reminding you to subscribe to the GreenSense Radio podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Help us help you. Head over to the greensensefarm.com website, click on radio show, and support our Podbean patron drive. Now more than ever, you need to support independent media so we can continue to put on great shows that feature sustainable innovations. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also check out the list of radio stations that air our show. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.